Good afternoon. This is At Issue on WGXC 90.7 FM and streaming at WGXC.org. I'm Victor Mandolia. Seth Rogovoy is not here this week. He had another engagement. But I'm here with Bruce Frischkoff and Michael O'Hara, who are, they are both with the Citizens Climate Lobby group, the Columbia County Chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby. And we're going to be talking a little bit about what they do. We had a very successful climate march on Saturday, and Bruce's wife spoke at it, which was great. So I thought we would expand on a little bit about what we were what she was talking about. She had 3 minutes. It's not really quite enough to discuss what you do. So tell us a little bit, what is the Citizens Climate Lobby, for those who don't know?
It is a group of citizens. I mean, that is the key word, because that's what we are. We're citizen volunteers who are working at trying to be effective in approaching the issue of climate change. And our approach, I'm looking at a sheet right in front of me about our core values. We are nonpartisan, regardless of what our individual politics may be on any particular issue. Our goal is to make a difference. Our goal is to harness citizen power, which we have and everybody has, to try to move some legislation through the Congress that will be effective in combating climate change.
And nonpartisan gets you in the door or gets you listened to? Is that the idea behind it?
Yes. It's a combination of several things.
Speak it right.
Our whole approach is to be appreciative, generous, really respectful of anybody we're dealing with. We know this is a Republican Congress. We have experience within Citizens Climate Lobby, both locally and nationally, of working with people whose policies started out being perhaps unresponsive in some ways, but through persistence, respect, good information, our being gently persuasive, we were able to have some results that we thought were very positive. The best local example I think of is what happened with my wife and Chris Gibson when she had gone with the Citizens Climate Lobby folks several times to Chris Gibson talking about our carbon fee and dividend proposal, which we'll talk about in a minute. And he was very respectful, but wasn't interested. She then approached him with a group of people who were a faith-based group, a Quaker, several people from different denominations. And he said, well, you know, I'm really not interested in that carbon fee and dividend. And she said, well, that's not really why we're here. We're really here to ask whether you'd be interested in doing a proposal, a resolution on climate and the effects of climate change. And he said, oh, sure, I'd be glad to do that. And it was her impression, their impression, that this was something he hadn't thought of before, but he was ready for. Mm-hmm. It was that work with him in a particular way that opened him to using his own values and connecting with the values of the people who were in the room in a way that was politically safe for him, but also moved forward what we felt was a very important question. And that became what is now known as the Republican Climate Resolution that how many Republicans have signed on to that now? I think 18 mm-hmm. Republicans in the House. And it's an example of what we try to do locally and nationally.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about what is the fee that you're talking about. What is I noticed that you don't call it a tax. So, and that's on purpose, I'm assuming.
It is. This came up years ago with some other fees and discussions in Congress about this issue. And Senator Moynihan's statement in response to that question was that a tax goes into the general fund and then is part of the fungible monies that are then spent on making government work for the people.
Mm-hmm.
So you build a road, you pay somebody's salary, all of that is coming out of the tax that goes into the general fund. A fee, on the other hand, is perhaps dedicated to a particular purpose. And in our case, it is sent back to the population, and so it doesn't stay in the general fund as a tax might.
Mm-hmm.
So we make a distinction there, although we acknowledge that somebody seeing money coming into the government is going to call it a tax if it suits their purposes,
right.
But that's fine. The essence of the proposal, though, is to impose a fee on fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, at the point where they enter the economy. So that's at the port, if it's imported, or a well, or a mine. So the amount of places where that could be done and the amount of entities that would pay the fee is fairly limited.
Mm-hmm.
This is a few thousand at most. One person with a spreadsheet could keep track of all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And the fee would be based on how much carbon these substances emit when you burn them. Our proposal starts out with a suggestion that we might start out at $15 a ton. $15 a ton then gets carried through in whatever you do with that substance. If you're using coal to heat water to make electricity, then that's would be wind up in the cost of the electricity. If
mm-hmm.
you're using natural gas to make fertilizer or pesticide or heat a house, of course, though each of those products would be influenced. Same with crude oil.
Mm-hmm.
Just for example, crude oil, having been taxed at $15 a ton at the beginning, would roll through the refining process and shipping and so forth, so that at the pump, for a gasoline delivery, it winds up being about 15 cents a gallon more. So just as an example,
mm-hmm.
the effect would vary, of course, depending on what it is you're doing.
Right.
So every part of the economy depends in some way at its source on the energy that you use to make or package or ship the products that we use every day. So everything would be influenced by that.
Mm-hmm.
And as it ripples through the economy, it would affect different parts of the population differently, but it would affect everybody. Whether you care about that effect is another thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the other end of the proposal, the dividend side, is that all of the money taken in, net a very small overhead for the administration of it, would be sent back to the population. Every household would get a check every month, which is the entire amount divided by the amount of adults and kids in the population,
mm-hmm.
so that adults would all get a full share and kids up to 18 would get a half a share. And so a family of four would have essentially three full shares. And the studies that we've had done on the effect on the population show that for the lowest income two-thirds of the population, the rebate that they get would more than equal the increased cost of goods and services that they would have experienced from the increase at the source.
Mm-hmm.
So for a whole lot of people, this means having net more money at the end of the month than they would have otherwise had. So there's a follow-on effect of this. The main effect that we're looking for is to move the entire economy towards a low carbon intensity.
Mm-hmm.
So that as you and I go to the store and we're presented with two items of apparent equal quality and appearance, the one that we would normally choose is the less expensive one. The manufacturer of all of these products, who is smart about this and sees that, oh, I'm going to be affected by this higher cost, will adjust their processes of packaging and
right.
heating and shipping and so forth
mm-hmm.
so that they can adapt to the new economic reality of the cost structure
mm-hmm.
among all the rest of the things that they have to be concerned about. But this is something that'll move the economy forward in that way towards lower carbon intensity. And the poorest among us will be reimbursed and then some for any negative effects that that might have had on them.
Hmm.
Now, the other aspect of that fee, though, we're starting out at X point, let's call it $15. We're further proposing that in an entirely predictable manner that that cost goes up every year. So $10 a ton is our current proposal,
mm-hmm.
10, 25, 35, 45, 55, et cetera. So if you are in business, let's say you're manufacturing something and you're in the market for a new piece of manufacturing equipment, a new printer or punch press or whatever the your factory needs, mm-hmm. well, of course, you'd be looking very highly at energy efficiency.
Right.
Materials efficiency. How much plastic or cardboard does your device need for packaging? What sort of truck are you going to buy to ship your product and mm-hmm. so forth?
Right.
So there's a lot of thought that somebody could put into this so that they come out ahead competitively or from a family point of view so that you have more money to spend on your family's needs at the end of the month. If you just want to let it ride and say, oh, I can... you know, essentially be revenue neutral as a family that says, you know, I paid $50 more this month, but I got $50, you know, back. Well, that's up to you. But if you decide to adjust your behavior, where you choose to live, what kind of vehicle you drive to get to work, what sort of products you buy, well, then there's the opportunity for you to actually come out with even more money in your pocket than your neighbor might.
Now, often at this point in a conversation is where we get people saying, that's fantasy, that's not going to happen. What about all the money the government will keep? How do you know this really works? One of the things I like about Citizens Climate Lobby is that people do their homework. And one of the things that the organization has done is to get REMI, the Regional Economic Models Incorporated group, which works not just works across the board for fossil fuel corporations, for government organizations, as a study group. They got them to do an in-depth study. And what they found was that if you trace this over a period of 20 years, what they saw that this would lead to is a 50% reduction of carbon emissions below 1990 levels. The addition of almost 3 million jobs above the baseline before this proposal was put into effect, driven by a real economic stimulus. They saw this as an effective market-based proposal, which is one of the reasons that we feel comfortable and confident approaching conservatives and saying, look, this is something that can work. And as people know, within the last 6 months, less than that, there's a conservative group, a number of older, well-established Republican, well-known names who came out with a proposal very similar to this carbon fee and dividend proposal because they see the market forces as being more favorable, something that they would prefer to a bunch of regulations.
Mm-hmm.
We don't say that. What we're saying is we think this is the first step. It's a step that could move things along. And we're very comfortable with all the other groups, our brother and sister groups, who have other proposals that they think would further reduce carbon emissions. But we see this as probably the most effective first step.
So how big is the Citizens Climate Lobby? How many chapters or how many people are involved nationwide?
We have a chapter in every congressional district. And we have about, 63,000 volunteers.
Wow. That's pretty big.
And the training, the follow-through. I mean, what got me involved, it wasn't just because, well, my wife was doing it, so I wanted to join in.
Mm-hmm.
The quality of the group that I've seen, certainly in Columbia County, I've never experienced a group before that does its homework, seems to enjoy each other so much, and yet stays with this and keeps doing the work and keeps reaching out and finding more people who are interested. It's what I hope, in fact, I hope personally that this is, we're seeing this across the board, not just with Citizens Climate Lobby. Mm-hmm. That's what I think I'm seeing locally and nationally.
Right.
People who will stay with it. And it's been very, very effective here. And we have all kinds of opportunities for connecting with people in chapters all across the country through various, through group phone calls, mm-hmm. through Zoom meetings. And what we're finding is that we can build on each other's success. I listen in and I hear what somebody's doing in Colorado and I say, gee, could we try that here?
Mm-hmm. So at this point, Chris Gibson looks like a flaming liberal compared to what the Congress is currently configured. How are you being received by Congressman Faso? Have you had a lot of talks with him? Is that on the agenda? What's going on?
Yes. Well, we started in on Mr. Faso before he got elected,
mm-hmm.
Understanding as it appeared at the time that he had a good chance to succeed Mr. Gibson. And got a good impression even then, mm-hmm. Because we asked Mr. Gibson to put in a good word for us.
Mm-hmm.
And once he did get elected, since then, we've met with him or his staff, I think it's 5 times so far, and mm-hmm. it's only May. So the response we've gotten, which is really what matters, the actions that he's performed are more than just nice verbiage in a private meeting.
Mm-hmm.
He's taken the step to co-sponsor the Republican climate resolution and to join what is called the Bipartisan Climate Caucus, which is a group made up of half Republicans and half Democrats in the House, which right. now totals 38 members.
Mm-hmm.
That have agreed to meet regularly on climate topics and keep the ball rolling on that. Most of the members of the Republican side of the House have also become, that signed the resolution, are also members of the caucus.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a bit of overlap there, but it also includes across the divide conversations, which is also helpful.
And it's also the same size. It's worth pointing out that that bipartisan caucus is the same size as the Freedom Caucus.
Right.
And when a group approaches 35 and more, then that group actually is in a position to start to try to influence mm-hmm. legislation.
Well, it's 10% of the body, so that's a pretty sizable amount.
Exactly. But on a larger scale, we have been getting impressions. We keep track. We've been at this for really actively 6 years nationwide, starting out with just a handful of people. And now we go to Washington every summer and have our annual convention and do an intensive lobby visit with every office on the Hill.
Mm-hmm.
All the House and Senate members get a visit. And we keep track of these things. And what we've seen is a steady improvement in a gradation of what sort of feedback we're getting from the staff, what their sense of possibility
mm-hmm.
is that from
door
slam almost. Nobody slams the door exactly, but they can be pretty darn
right.
Just brief with you.
Right.
Let's talk and let's really get into this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been going for 3 years now. And I sat through a meeting with one of the staff people of a senator from Wyoming. And this fellow had written a book about why climate change was total hoax and bunk mm-hmm. and so forth. And he spent an hour with us. And by the end of the hour, he had kind of used up all his arguments. and we don't argue with people about the science of climate change.
Right.
We take advantage of the multidimensional nature of this proposal,
mm-hmm.
the fact that we're proposing something that will create jobs in their district.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that people...
So how does that happen? How does it create jobs?
The 60% of the population who will have a net benefit
mm-hmm.
at the end of the month means that those people will spend that money. Poor people spend every cent they have.
Right.
And so they'll go out and buy child care and food and transportation. And that stimulates the economy in which they live in the most dispersed method means imaginable.
Mm-hmm.
So it works as an economic stimulus better than designing a big project that you hope some construction worker is going to get a job for a few months at.
So if 60% of the population is getting a net plus,
yes,
then who pays?
Well, everybody pays. It's just who feels...
But who's going to get a net negative?
The higher income, two-fifths of the population.
Mm-hmm. And that's because they consume more?
Yes. Yeah, it turns out that most of the carbon footprint of a family is not in the electricity or fuel that they use. It's in the stuff that they buy,
mm-hmm,
all the clothes and hardware and cars and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
It has embodied in it the energy that it took to make it and ship it and package it and so forth.
Right.
And so that adds up in a richer family to be a carbon footprint of many times that of a poorer family.
Mm-hmm.
So they would,
and not having much to do with what people traditionally think about,
correct,
as energy use.
Right. I mean, they they might have a very efficient house with good insulation and set the thermostat low like good citizens, but mm-hmm, on the other hand, they have a 10,000 square foot house,
right,
that, you know, cost whatever it cost to build.
Mm-hmm.
So those people, though, are not going to feel the pinch. For them, an extra few dollars of expense on this or that is not going to be impactful on their life.
Mm-hmm. So if you're just joining us, we're with Bruce Frischkoff. I keep doing it. Frischkoff, who is, and Michael O'Hara, who are both with the Citizens Climate Lobby chapter in Columbia County. So as far as, I know that you and I, Michael, we've spoken before, and you're very pessimistic about where the climate is and where our ability to go backwards and try to fix it. So can you give us an update on where you think things are? I know it's – I think we have to be realistic here as well.
We're in an awful situation, for sure.
Yeah.
But just parenthetically, Citizens Climate Lobby that I encountered – 3.5 years ago is the only thing that really gives me any hope.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is acceptable to Republican and Democratic political operatives and to economists on both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
It makes economic sense and it makes political sense. So that gives me a bit of hope.
And then there's the political will. That's a different thing.
Well,
right?
that's
and that's what you're doing.
That's what we're about.
Right.
Political will is not really generated from the top. It comes from the grassroots. So in addition to sitting down with staff members of our House and Senate members, we spend time on letters to the editor and editorials and radio shows,
mm-hmm,
and all manner of things to get people out and get them thinking about this. Our presentation, we had an event at the Opera House in January that featured the idea of carbon farming.
Mm-hmm.
Carbon farming, in a nutshell, is agricultural practices that tend to avoid releasing carbon dioxide from the soil into the atmosphere and actually can capture carbon dioxide from the air by proper farming technology and just practices. What time of the season you do something, what kind of plow you use, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a dynamite speaker who presented the case for this as a farmer and as a business person. He's also just, by the way, a college professor who deals with the biology of this in great detail, shows how it works. And at the tail end of the meeting, Dee Dee Barrett, our assemblywoman, introduced the proposal that she's put before the New York State Legislature to incent farmers to adopt these practices that will, I think, be a wonderful example for states all over the country.
And how does it work? How does the carbon farming work? How do you store the carbon?
Essentially, it's a matter of finding different ways of keeping the carbon in the ground. And it can go from everything from no-till farming to there are all kinds of practices being used all over the world for holistic management involving certain kinds of selective of grazing of cattle. There are all these different systems, some of which are very, very old, that people have, for all kinds of reasons, moved away from over time. But if there's legislation, if there's an incentive for farmers to, in a sense, return to some of these practices and feel that they're not losing out economically, that raises the possibilities that some of the carbon can stay in the ground. Agriculture is under pressure this way. Farmers, as we know very well around here and all across the country, most farmers don't have it easy economically.
Right.
They can't really be thinking just about, the social good they're providing. At the same time, for a number of reasons, agriculture can be seen to be producing more carbon emissions than some other areas of business. So this was a very sensible proposal by her, a very welcome proposal, mm-hmm. to try to find a way of changing the balance a little bit and encourage farmers to use practices that would benefit the environment, benefit the climate, and at the same time not hurt them but actually help them economically.
Mm-hmm. Right. If I can give another more specific example of a farming practice, if you think of the classic what is called a moldboard plow, it's kind of a V-shaped piece of iron that gets dragged mm-hmm. through the soil
right.
with a point on it, and as the point enters the soil and the slopes on the side pick up the soil, it actually turns over the soil. And I guess that seemed like a good idea at the time, but embedded in the organic material of the soil is elemental carbon.
Mm-hmm.
It's just pure carbon wrapped up with some other molecules. And when that gets exposed to the air, it combines with the oxygen and becomes carbon dioxide.
Right.
And just floats away. And does nobody any good.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways in which you can farm today is instead of putting a plow through the soil that lifts it up and turns it upside down, you take what looks like a pizza cutter ganged up with 50 other pizza cutters on a big rack behind mm-hmm. the tractor, and each of these pizza cutters is cutting a slice into the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
That is just a fraction of an inch wide. It's not very big at all. You can hardly see it to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And in some configurations, you can have a device which follows along behind each pizza cutter, each disc, that inserts a seed at intervals and perhaps a little bit of fertilizer
mm-hmm.
so that in the same motion through the field, you've cut a hole, you've dropped a seed in, and you've moved on.
Right.
And so the intact surface area, which has perhaps a cover crop that you haven't dug up and turned over, now protects the open soil from erosion. It holds the water better than it would have as bare soil
mm-hmm.
and protects the growing crop that you want to raise better than it would have been protected otherwise.
Probably uses less energy to drag it through the soil as well. Right?
Exactly. So it has a lot of benefits
right.
To it. And that's just one example of what they call low-till farming.
I see.
And there's others. But mm-hmm. Didi's incentive that's built into the legislation allows a farmer to say to himself, oh, that looks like a good idea. Let me try it next season, but I'll have to perhaps buy new equipment
mm-hmm.
and change the practices over a season, and I'm not quite sure how it works. So here's some tax break that I can be assured of
mm-hmm.
Based on what I spend so
right.
that I'm not going to be totally left out to dry if the way that I do it turns out not to work very well.
So we're nearly out of time. Tell people how they could get more involved with Citizens Climate Lobby.
Well, there is the website, which is citizensclimatelobby.org. Very simple.
That's a good place to start.
And it's a very good place because once somebody gets there, you'll find the wealth of information seems overwhelming, but actually very exciting, mm-hmm. very enriching. So that's certainly one way. Our chapter meets usually the second Monday of the month, usually in Chatham. We'll be meeting on the 15th of May, 11 Kinderhook Street in Chatham. And people can certainly contact my wife Karen, who's one of the group leaders, at 672-7901. And she will be glad to talk to people. Anybody who's interested in Citizens Climate Lobby gets a very personal response. This isn't just, would you please put your name on a list? Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. We appreciate your vote.
That's great.
And so there are lots of opportunities for this kind of involvement, and we hope that people will be interested.
You have anything else?
Exactly. The other aspect of the website is that there's a place to put in your name and address, and we'll get notified here in our chapter because mm-hmm. of the address that you put in.
I see.
So we're organized by congressional district, so anybody from the New York 19 of Mr. Faso, their name would be sent to us, and we would then reach out to them locally and talk about meetings and
Great.
So forth, because we have several other sub-chapters
That's right.
which are located in what is an 11-county large right. District, so that we can have people get involved in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been with Bruce Frischkoff and Michael O'Hara from the Citizens Climate Lobby chapter here in Columbia County. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be with Joyce St. George, who has been investigating and dogging Reclaim New York, which is a Steve Bannon front organization that is going to get very active here in New York 19. So we'll be right back on WGXC 90.7 FM and WGXC.org. ACRA.
To the one I love, this is dedicated. To the one I love.
Hi, Joyce. Can you hear me?
I sure can.
Oh, great. Okay.